Greetings. Oh, people who like other people. How nice to come in here, the sound of connection, human voices. I was sitting for a Dokusan this morning, and we were just sitting quietly before we started speaking, and I heard a little and a whole bunch of geese flew by. It's kind of like you all. Animals getting it done together. It's pretty much the only way it works. So I'm so happy to be here. This is very sweet. I'm going to give a talk today that is about community and lineage. Community being one of the most fundamental aspects of our tradition, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Sangha being community of practice. And I'm thinking of this because I just got back from a big trip. I was on a book tour and visited about 20 different Zen centers on this leg of the trip, which was out to the west. And then in the fall, I did a similar trip to the east. So I've been to about 40 different practice communities in the last 6 months. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to talk about all the amazing and wonderful things people are doing? So, book tour sounds kind of like I'm really into retail sales. So the fact that I get to travel around with a box full of things, selling it out of the back of my car is inspiring, but the trips are about connection. They're about fostering and recognizing the connection that is here. And so, I just want to kind of pass this along. So I got to visit places in a lot, mostly Zen places, although, and I think I'm just going to talk about Zen practice places today, although I visited a lot of different kinds of things. Talking about Zen practice places, places from a lot of different sort of lineages in terms of how the seeds were planted here on North American soil. So I just want to talk about, where we think of ourselves as in the Katagiri lineage, because Dainin Katagiri founded this temple. I visited a lot of places in the Maizumi Roshi lineage, which is now often just called the White Plum Sangha, because he said, I'm making this White Plum lineage. And Maizumi is one of the early teachers to come from Japan and start a Zen practice place and start empowering teachers here in North America. I founded Zen Center of Los Angeles, which is a wonderful place. And, you may have heard of Joan Halifax. I would say probably the most prominent Zen Buddhist in North America. Charlotte Joko Beck, Bernie Glassman, all students of Maizumi Roshi, and his lineage thrives. People who trained in that lineage, including Angel Kyoto Williams, Jules Chuzun Harris, Jose Shinzon Palmer, Koshin and Chodo over at the New York Zen Center. Just amazing, beautiful people carrying forward something. I don't know if you know about Kennett Roshi, founded Shasta Abbey, and so I got to visit Dharma Rain, which is a very large sort of temple complex, I would say, in Portland, Oregon, in the Kennett Roshi lineage. Kennett Roshi, she went and trained in Japan and was what probably, was the first Western woman to ever receive full teaching empowerment in a Japanese Zen tradition, came back. And, one of the great things about all these different places, they do think differently. She was raised in England and was originally going to be an Anglican priest. So when you go to places in that Shasta Abbey tradition, in the Kennett Roshi tradition, all the chants are Gregorian chants in Japanese. So you're chanting in Japanese, but there's a and there's they have harmony lines written on paper. Who can read that anymore? Anyway, quite wonderful. Many Katagiri lineage places I was able to visit. So that's kind of close family. Kobunchino, went up to Jikoji Zen Center in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is just above Palo Alto. Kobunchino was an early assistant of Suzuki Roshi. Kobunchino is known for being kind of a nut, kind of a live wire very unpredictable person. So he planted seeds. When you go to places in the Kobun-Chino tradition, when you go into a ritual, I mean, it's all the normal Soto Zen ritual that we, very similar to what we do here 5 days a week in the morning. But the vibes are distinct. So the first time I ever came to Jikoji, I got there, and it's a residential place with maybe 8 or 9 residents, and then they welcome the community in at certain times. And I came in, and I was like, well, I'm here to, you know, be here for a couple days and do some teaching. And I found the guest manager, and she said, oh, okay, Ben, hi, nice to meet you. Listen, we're in the middle of a dance class, so follow me. And, like, I just put my backpack down, and we walked into the Zendo, and I learned how to cha-cha. So... people do things differently. How wonderful is that? On this trip, I learned of a whole woman named Joan Sutherland, who founded a whole thing called Open Source Koan Study. And I guess there's Zen centers, numerous Zen centers that she founded and are practicing in this distinct way that she has. And all her students were just raving about how amazing she was. I was like, well, I don't even know. How wonderful. My ignorance. One of the wonderful things about traveling is you realize the vastness of your ignorance, which is really the main thing that I was trying to transmit. I was teaching Vasubandhu, and he's really about, like, just realize how much you don't know, how much is left out in how you think you've got it figured out, the vastness of what is left out. So that was very wonderful. And also amazing, because their chanting is melodic, and one of their members was really excited to chant to me the Cajun style Heart Sutra, which I can't repeat, but was very surprising. It didn't have any, you know, sage on it, but the rhythm was special. You know, across these traditions, there's a lot of, by the way, you might be like, I came here to learn how to meditate. What are you doing? I'm talking about the Dharma. It's about people and how they live. Anyway, so many places, I went to a lot of places in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, you know, through San Francisco Zen Center, and of course, Tim Burkett, who was a teacher, guiding teacher here for a long time and is still here, was obviously, life was completely transformed by Suzuki, because 90% of what he says is stories about Suzuki Roshi. But anyway, you know, I went to San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara and a bunch of other places, and very frequently we would find, you know, like, oh, come into the founder's altar, I'll go in and make some bows, and it's like, oh, there's a Katagiri Roshi memorial tablet, just like we have in the founder's hall, or the Buddha hall here. I went up to this beautiful memorial site where some of Suzuki Roshi's ashes are interred to pay respects and make bows when I arrived at Tassajara. And there's a couple other stones there, and I learned that one of them is a memorial stone for Katagiri Roshi, and some of his ashes are there. So these twining vines of relationship, you know, in the ancient Chan literature, they frequently refer to Zen as a family-style practice. It's a family-style practice. So, you know, I'm going to do a retreat with Mingyur Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan teacher. And the style there really is, you go, maybe your teacher comes, they're going to give you teachings, like a fire hose of teachings for 2 days, and then they're going to go somewhere else, and you're going to use that to practice, which is beautiful. But in the Soto Zen style, the idea really is we come in this building together, and we do life. And I was really stoked. This is a talk about diversity of practice, or eventually will be. And I was here yesterday for work practice day, and I've had to miss a lot, so I was really happy to be here. And we had a very low turnout, no pressure. But it's really fun to clean house together. And it was 3 priests and 2 people who have, like, only been here once before. And I was like, this is amazing. Who enters practice through the Dharma gate of, like, I'm going to clean the toilets for you guys? Someone came here who's barely ever been here and cleaned the toilets for you. Yesterday, amazing, amazing. So I visited Zen Shuji, which was the first North American Soto Zen Mission, and there actually was a 100-year anniversary celebration actually going on right now. It's like a multi-day event. And they had a different, how did that, I'll talk to someone about that. They've had multiple 100 anniversary celebrations in the last year. I mean, they're all in the same year, so we'll give them that. Anyway, I went down there and visited. I have a very close friend who works there named Gyoke Yokoyama. And I met some of the staff there and was able to attend a service. And, you know, it's cool. They're like, this is a mission and we are missionaries. Gyoke is like, I am a missionary. So that's just interesting perspective, you know? I was like, they're coming over here and planting seeds on this soil with these weird, ignorant people. they would not put it that way. They would not put it that way. Well, how wonderful. To make the effort to cross an ocean, come to a different culture and environment to try and share something that you think is beautiful. And, you know, I was going to say this later, but I'll just say it now. At Zen Shuji, we're going to have Dokkan, who's on staff at Zen Shuji, is going to come here June 18th to give a talk on Monday. I hope that the date right. We don't usually have talks on Monday, so be ready. Yeah, and actually, they're going to send three people from the Soto Zen Mission. Two of them are Japanese folks, Shoshin and Dokkan, who are staying in the U.S. temporarily. And the person who's going to give the talk, Eijo, trained in Japan for a long time, and he's a Westerner, a white Westerner. But he speaks really good English, so they asked him to give the talk. But anyway, if you come, you'll have an opportunity to meet them, and they're really wonderful people. And so we're just making these connections. So, you know, it's wonderful. People plant seeds, people found temples, people are really amazing. I mean, obviously, Maizumi Roshi must have been pretty amazing to have inspired incredible teachers like Joan Halifax, Bernie Glassman, and Charlotte Joko Beck. But it is also, it's worth just acknowledging that these amazing teachers who are so inspiring make mistakes and harm people. You know, Maizumi Roshi was an alcoholic and he died an alcoholic death and he did a lot of harmful things in his life, sexual transgressions. Our founder Katagiri had sexual relationships with a couple of his students even though he was married, which has done, you know, profound harm, the reverberations of which we still live with. I visited a temple that was founded by one of Baker Roshi's Dharma heirs. Baker Roshi, who, like, you know, at San Francisco Zen Center precipitated a total crisis around abuse of power. His student is wonderful. Zenki Christian Dillo is an amazing person. Who knows? I am getting used to the fact that we are just people, and people can be inspiring and amazing and do incredible things and make profound mistakes and do harms. And it doesn't mean the harms don't matter. It just means this is what we have to work with as a community. So there's been awesome work done by many people about how to create communities of practice that are safe for people, because a lot of the harms that have been done by teachers were done by men as sexual transgressions, heterosexual men with women. A lot of the work has been done around protecting against sexual abuse. And Zen Center of Los Angeles, where Maizumi was teacher, they pioneered this work, and they've helped bring it out to other communities. Wendy Ngokyu and Gyoku Nagao is just a total inspiration. And transforming how leadership works at her temple so that people are like, we need you. She's like, okay, I will serve you. She served for like 15, 20 years as their abbot. And it's a big place. And now she's like, no one should ever have to do this again. We're having a diversified leadership with multiple teachers, with different roles, with much more balanced power. And, you know, they're changing things. And at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, of which I was recently president, which is like a national body of like 250 Zen teachers, you know, we just passed a new ethics policy that is designed to protect people from harms that are committed by people in power, like me. So if you see me doing something harmful, I'm asking you to tell me. But it's my responsibility to not do it. I get that. But we're doing this together, ultimately. So anyway, vibes are different in these different communities. Like, just the organizational structure is different. So like, I went to this one place where they're like, we have no teacher. We're just totally community organized. We just, you know, revolving flux of people who get stuff done. And they're like, it's pretty awesome. Also, it's really frustrating. I wonder if we should get a teacher. Yes. Yeah. And then when you have a really powerful teacher, you're like, gosh, we have a little more diversified structure. Yeah. We're just working it out. There's not an answer. There's a process. Mahayana Buddhism says there's only relationship and there's only process. Dharma Bum Temple. That place is cool. It's just like a community place. The founder, Jeffrey Slotnick, trained in Taiwan for a long time, came home, and he was just like, yeah, I don't do a lot of teaching. I just make space for lots of people to come in, meditate, connect. We have all different kinds of affinity groups. Very beautiful. They don't do retreats there. It's just a community place where people can find some peace and quiet. And then a lot of the places I went are residential facilities. So actually, it's quite strange. It's very humbling when I go there and they're like, oh, you're going to give a talk. And I'm like, everyone here has lived in a monastery for 15 years. It's very humbling. Not everyone, you know, but there'll be lots of people who've lived in residence for a really long time. And this is really worth talking about here. What we're doing here in terms of all the kinds of things we offer at this Zen Center and at similar Zen Centers is pretty weird. How many institutions do you know of that there are people right now in this building who have never been to a Zen Center before at the intro with Carrie across the hall? People who've never meditated, don't know anything about Buddhism and Zen, they're right over there. And then we also have people here who are ordained, who have trained in this space their entire training or the main body of their training until they have essentially a terminal degree. And generally, we're all in the same room. This is like the fancy time where we're separated into two categories. But almost all the time is we all just get together. So this is like if you had all your doctoral students, all your doctoral graduates, and all the people entering like your high school, college course on science, or high school or college course on science, you're like, yep, we're all just going to figure out how to do this together. It's weird. It's an unusual structure. And it's worth just acknowledging that that creates, you know, it can be like, well, many people here are people that were just people I walked in the door with 20 years ago, and now I'm sitting here giving a talk. That's just a little strange dynamic. It seems to work, but it's worth noting. Doing it together. And the cool thing is, like, it only really works because we're all here. Certainly it is only whatever it is because we're all here. Like, this is what it is. That's always true. That sounds pretty Zen. But wow. So in one of our root texts of our tradition, The Harmony of Difference and Sameness by Sherto, it says, each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. Each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. And you could translate this, each of the myriad beings has its merit. I'll say, each of the myriad beings has their merit expressed according to function and place. Wow. We all have room, like, we make this be what it is. Beginner's mind is one of the highest aspirations of this tradition. For me to remember the mind that walked in the door and didn't know anything, and for all of us to have that capacity, and for some of us to be the kind of people who show up for our first time here and wash toilets, and for other ones of us to be like, I really want to learn minute techniques for meditation. Well, you may have come to the wrong place. or, you know, I'm just a person who I really want to read all these fancy books that are so complicated. Cool. Or like, why do they have to read all those complicated books at the Zen Center? You don't have to. You don't have to. We have to provide, or I think it is really important for us to provide a very broad diversity of training, because we are training priests at this place who are the people who are intended to be empowered to carry forward the lineage of Soto Zen on North American soil. So training in Oryoki, training in ritual, training in the Dharma, training in how to clean toilets, training in how to listen to people with a vast, spacious compassion, training in how to walk so that you know your feet are the entire earth. These are things that are really important to do here, but not everyone has to do all of them. You can be like, that's my path. Yeah, you can find your space in here. So I'm just going to talk about some cool stuff I saw at different Zen centers. I'm going to talk about diversity, which means a lot of things. It means different stuff. That's another word for diversity, different things. But actually, I'm going to talk first about diversity in terms of the way people often think about it, in terms of diversity of demographics in community. And so I went to, so I've been to like 40 places, so I invite you to not try and guess the place I'm talking about right now, ever. But I went to a place several years ago, because I've done these teaching tours for a long time. And as is usual, as is common for me, I talked about how Mahayana Buddhism, when we make a vow to liberate all beings, that includes dismantling the oppressive structures in which we live. You know, things like racism and patriarchy and anti-Semitism and transphobia and homophobia and Islamophobia, climate change, addiction, which is a systemic problem. Anyway, so I'm like, if we're making this vow, let's actually do it. Anyway, so then oftentimes that kind of narrows down to I'll talk about a particular kind of thing, and it's not uncommon for me to talk about race, and it's not uncommon for people to freak out when you talk about race, because it brings up very difficult emotions, because it is in the human body of North America as a massive trauma. So it can be really hard. It can be really hard for people. And anyway, I was at this place that I was visiting, and I was talking about race and what our Buddhist practice and teachings can do to help us dismantle harmful racial structures. And the situation got very fraught, so there was some people who got really upset. They just got really activated in ways that were complicated. And a lot of those folks were white folks. And in a sense, they just wanted to feel like racism was somewhere else, and not think of it as something that was part of the water we swim in, where we have agency for liberation. So it was painful, and some people of color there were very upset, and I felt pretty bad. I went to the person who invited me to be there, and I'm sorry, am I breaking your sangha? And he said, I trust you implicitly, and this is really important work, and we're going to work through this together. And they had already been doing what we call affinity groups. So they had like white awareness group, and they had a people of color group. And they had already been doing that for a while, and they've kept doing that for years, which is really cool. Anyway, I went back there just recently and gave a similar kind of talk, where I was talking about how the Mahayana vow invites us to dismantle oppressive structures, race harms people, we're part of the system, we can do something about it. And the vibe was, yeah, let's do that. And the much larger number of people of color who were in leadership at the institution 5 years later was pretty noticeable. And the reactivity of the white folks to the conversation was unbelievably diminished. And I was like, oh, this is cool. This is cool. It's almost like if you do practices, they can have an effect. So anyway, If you ever look at our calendar, you're like, why do they have that awakening to race thing, which is for white people to talk about dismantling oppressive racist structures? It's because I want to live in that world where we believe that what we do matters, where we don't have to keep having the same things. And it's beautiful to have time. You know how, like, you see a kid, and I just saw a kid I used to give guitar lessons to, who's like, he was little, and I ran into him yesterday, and I didn't recognize him because he's like taller than me now, right? This is what happens when you leave for a little while, and you can really see what happens when people make that commitment to a practice, the transformation that can occur. And this will happen with your personal practice. You're like, I just sit on this stupid cushion and I don't even know. I just think a lot and then I obsess and then I hear a bird and then a bell rings. What's going on? And, you know, 5 years later, someone that you know says, wow, it just feels different to be around you. It feels good. I feel a peace and a stillness and a care. So anyway, people do all kinds of awesome stuff. I got invited to a tea ceremony at Jikoji with someone who's been doing tea for years. I've done like one Japanese tea ceremony ever. And it was really, I was kind of like, oh, I just finished the session. I've been silent and attentive all day and I just want to eat a pizza. But I've been invited, I'm not turning this down. And I walked over there and it's in a deep ravine at the top of a ridge at the top of the mountains. It's very heavily vegetated and there's, you know, stuff's falling out of the trees constantly. It's a forest. And there's a little mud path from the main complex to the tea hut. And it was entirely evident that in preparation, having just completed a two-day session with me, this person, knowing that I and Ocean Jennings were going to come for a tea ceremony, had hand-swept 100 yards of mud path to clear all the leaves and sticks off of it, just so we could walk there in a beautiful way. Since life matters, we can just act like it. It's cool. Sowing lineages are a deep fabric of connection that connects across all our communities. So I was able to, you know, talk to people who are the sewing teachers at all these different Zen centers who'd have wonderful stories about Rosemary and Fiona, who are Zen teacher, are sewing teachers here now, and Tomoe-san, who founded the tradition on North American soil, arguably, with her teacher, Eishin Yoshida. And I met for a while with my friend Victoria Austin, who's like, I got this fabric in India from the place where Gandhi founded the weaving tradition that was like this revolutionary movement against the appropriation of fabric making in India. She said, I got this fabric there. I want you to take this and give it to Fiona. It's on my altar at home. I'm waiting to hear from Fiona. Those connections, offerings. Cooking is cool. You all know Zen cooking is a big deal. The Dogen Zenji is just like the Tenzo is like the greatest. The cook on a retreat or in a monastery is the person who's almost so inspiringly embodying the practice that I'm talking about. And it's real. Like at Tassajara, they have a really deep cooking culture there. And I've been there before when they have guests, a lot of like they open up as kind of a resort and they make all this enormous amounts of fancy food, which is really good. But I was there this time and it was just practitioners and it was just three bowls every day. Excellent, beautiful food. But on the last day, Jay, who's not here, but is one of our priests, happened to be at Tassajara with me and they made cookies for us. Jay made cookies and they were magical. They were magic cookies. I don't know what Jay did to make them magical, but they did it. And I will bless them forever. It was bringing the heart of practice to the activity. I went to ZCLA and we sat Zazen, and then it was time for walking meditation. So, I don't know, probably a lot of you have done Kinhin in here. You know, we walk really slowly. It's super organized. It's just like sort of classic Zodo Zen vibe of like all the bodies moving in total harmony, like the slowest, most boring dance ever imagined. But so beautiful and so centering. And I got to ZCLA and they rang the bell and they said, walking meditation. And everyone got up, walked outside, and just started walking very briskly, total rando, all over the grounds of this huge facility. I was like, someone has to tell me what to do. I'm a Zodo Zen guy. And I was like, oh, I guess I just walk around. It's like you could just walk around. It was great. And then the bell rang and we all sat down. Wonderful. Just walk around with your whole being. And, you know, because there's no organization, then everyone has to be very attentive to each other, right? So that when you come around a corner, you make room. Doing it together. I went to one place where they have some extra land, and they're like, I feel bad talking about this prematurely because they may not be able to work it out. They might be like, dude, don't talk about that publicly. But they didn't tell me not to talk about it publicly, and I'm not telling you who it is. They're basically like, we have some land, and what we're focusing huge amount of energy on is creating housing for unhoused people on this land, which is our temple land. And it's complicated. It takes a lot of money, and there's huge amounts of bureaucratic stuff to go through. But it was really inspiring. And by the way, this happened at Plymouth Church in Minneapolis. They were like, we have this huge expensive property and there are people living on the street right outside. It's ridiculous. So they built a bunch of housing across the street and that blossomed into what's called Beacon Interfaith Housing, which has created many, many housing projects all over the Twin Cities. If you want to get involved with a cool group, Beacon Interfaith is awesome. Went to one place where they're like, yeah, we have our Zen Center, it's awesome, and then a bunch of us have a huge mindfulness program teaching in hospitals and very, very developed mindfulness-based stress reduction program that's kind of housed through their Zen Center. I went to one place where, when I left, they just handed me like a stack of beautiful handmade gifts from calligraphy, wrapping cloths. These people who trained and live and are from Japan, and so they had all these particular kinds of handicrafts, some I'd never seen before. Wow. Wow. We can do all different kinds of stuff. For a tradition where Dogen Zenji was just like, just sit Zazen. Okay, and maybe cook. Okay, and maybe walk. Okay, and maybe listen to people. Okay, and maybe show up and help out with every possible situation that arises. That's Zazen. Zazen is total engagement with what's happening. That's what it is. So anyway, one of the things that I got to do a lot on this trip that I don't get to do here, and maybe you don't get to do here, is chant in Sino-Japanese. So when I first arrived, we would do some Sino-Japanese is a version of Japanese that uses Chinese characters and is very ancient and is often not understandable to Japanese people, but is a normal way of engaging with Buddhist texts in Japan. So a lot of time, is my understanding, is like if you go to a temple in Japan, you'll chant in Sino-Japanese, and you might not know any of the words you're saying or really be able to interpret what it means, but you just chant. Because you're in a temple, and you're with people making sounds and realizing, like, this is a way of practice. Someone who's really into this, I'm going to credit Raymond for prompting me to bring this up. Someone who's really into chanting in Sino-Japanese is Tina Turner. very devoted practitioner of Nichiren SGI Buddhism, where the main chant is Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. And I'll be actually chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo at a wedding I'm officiating this afternoon for an SGI practitioner. So this is for some people, this chanting in Sino-Japanese is the root of their practice. But we took out all the Sino-Japanese chanting here at MZMC for various reasons. People are just like, why do we want to chant stuff? We don't know what it is. We're in North America. Every time that Buddhist traditions have come to new soil, at some point they've started using the language of the people in that place or the languages of that people in that place. And in fact, in the Pali Canon, in the earliest layer of literature, Buddha specifically enjoins his followers to do so. He says, when you travel to new places, do not use the Vedic script. Do not use the ancient languages of ritual. Use the languages that people can understand. Anyway, having said that, let's use a language we don't understand. It'll be fun. So in a minute, I'm going to lead this chant. Because I love you all so much, I'm just going to tell you what a translation of the chant might look like, which is Kanzeon. This is the Bodhisattva of compassion who listens to the sound of the world as a way of manifesting the vastness of their compassion. Kanzeon, at one with Buddha, directly Buddha, also indirectly Buddha, and indirectly Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, joyful, pure, eternal being. Morning mind is Kanzeon. Evening mind is Kanzeon. Nen-nen arises from mind. Nen-nen is not separate from mind. I don't know what nen-nen is. I don't think anyone else does. Some of these are nonsensible syllables. Tra-la-la, my friends. Tra-la-la. Shoo-be-doo. Yay, nakine. Yes, nonsense. It's good. So let's see. Raymond, could you just hand that up to me? So when we chant here, we generally chant in octaves. So some voices are going to be down here. Kanze on namu butsu yo butsu in yo butsu in. And some of the voices will be up. Traditionally, people with male bodies will chant that bottom pitch and female bodies the upper pitch. But you can choose the pitch that seems right to you based on your gender identity. So, we're going to chant this numerous times. You'll know we're ending because I'll slow down, okay? And if you don't want to chant, you don't have to. If you don't want to listen, you're going to have to get some really good earplugs. Because this is what I forgot to say, why I was so inspired to do this, was at Buddha Eye, the chanting was so powerful. I sat down for the Dharma talk, and we did the opening of the sutra verse, an unsurpassed penetrating. And I literally, it felt like the building was lifting up. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma. But every single voice in the room was pouring their whole being into the sound. So I'm inviting you, don't yell, but don't hold back. All right. Here we go. I'll chant the title, and then we can chant together. En me juku kanan gyo kanze yon namu butsu yo butsu u in yo butsu u en mu po so en jo raku ga jo cho nen kanze yon bo nen kanze yon nen nen ju shin ki nen nen fu ri shin kanze yon na mu butsu yo butsu in yo butsu en mu po so en jo raku ga jo cho nen kanze yon bo nen kanze yon nen nen ju shin ki nen nen fu ri shin kanze yon na mu butsu yo butsu in yo butsu en mu po so en jo raku ga jo cho nen kanze yon bo nen kanze yon nen May all the benefit of this recitation be an offering to the liberation of all beings throughout space and time. All right, doing the Dharma. Yeah, thank you so much for jumping into that. Rima, can I ask you this? Thank you. So, yeah, chanting, bowing, listening, walking, cooking, cleaning the floors, planting the flowers. Someone took out a lot of plants here that were in the way of the flowers. So all the plants that were in the way of the flowers, I bow to you as you have been given to the compost. And I bow to you to the people who took those out, because the garden looks so beautiful. To just be able to come here and have a space where people walking by can just walk in. This place means something to people. Various things, but for many people, a place of peace, of stillness, of compassion. And so we can commit to making that available. So there's all the different ways people are practicing, all different lineages, but at the end of Dogen's universal recommendation for Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi says, although each lineage expresses its own style, they are all simply devoted to sitting totally blocked in resolute stability. Although there are 1,000 distinctions and 10,000 variations, they all just wholeheartedly engage the way in Zazen. And this was true. Everywhere I went, we would sit in an upright posture, place the hands in the cosmic mudra, and then the universe would happen. And we did it together in a space, in a room together. I'm giving the talk next week, and I think my talk is going to be about why Zazen is collective. It's not about making your mind into something else. Well, some people are going to be more into Zazen than others. That's fine. But Zazen gives us this opportunity to recognize and also cultivate a total engagement with reality. Not with the narrow little story our mind is making, but with what is real right now. This moment of relationship, this particular moment of process. And I have a deep faith that this is a profound offering for the world. So thank you all very much for your kind attention. Now we have time for other voices, questions, reflections, comments. Comments, it's always nice if they're brief and concise, given the size of our group. Questions can be of any kind that seems meaningful to you. And answers, I will do my best. And if you're online, you can just unmute and speak. I think we should hear you. Anyway, yeah, anyone want to say anything? Ask.
Being that there's probably as many methods as there are people, What's a way of viewing or understanding if you're going off the path, if there's such a thing?
Wow. Being is, there are so many methods and people. What's the way of knowing if you're going off the path? Yeah, what a good question. Because from one perspective, like what's most important is just discerning what in one zenkwan, it says what's an appropriate response. Or from a, like an early Buddhist language, it's like what is beneficial, what is unwholesome. So, kind of cultivating that discernment is the fundamental question to some extent. But it is good, a couple of good sources to look for is in your own intuition about your values. So like the path to me is not like you should be doing Soto Zen. The path is liberation for all beings from suffering. And I happen to do it Soto Zen. That's what I hope everyone will do. So anyway, yeah, one is your intuition. Sometimes you just kind of know, I bet. And another is people you really trust. So like talking to people about it. What is my life about with the path that I'm walking? Is it honoring my values and creating the world I want to see? And then another one is the people you really don't know or often don't hear from. So that because we can get in a little echoey realm. And so it's useful to listen to diverse voices, and you don't have to believe them all. So the ones who are like, oh, you know, tell me I'm just going to burn in eternal hell for what I'm doing. I don't necessarily believe that, but I'm willing to listen. But then there are many voices that are kind of suppressed. So internally, trusted friends on the path, and then looking out so we don't get too involuted. So that's my thoughts. Thank you.
Ben?
Yeah.
Could you say, make any generalizations about how you think Western Buddhism, Soto Zen Buddhism is evolving from what you've seen here over the last, you know, 5-10 years? What's the next 5-10 years look like? Any changes, trends?
That's a great question. I do think I tend to see an increasing awareness of the interdependence that we have with oppressive systems and a willingness to engage that and transform it. I would say that is a distinct change that I see in a lot of places. And I think that is a beneficial thing. Having said that, that's like, well, that's something I'm really interested in, so isn't it interesting that I notice it? But I would be noticing it in a different way if it wasn't happening, and I would be letting people know, you know? So that is true. Other than that, it's pretty tough. I think there's a great, you know, there's a great book called American Dharma by Ann Glegg, and it's basically, this is very fancy sounding, it's an academic book, but she's like, we are clearly in a postmodern Buddhist era, which is to say the idea that like there's these monolithic one structures that can be, it's really clear, you track this is what it is, just doesn't give you a clear picture. What you have to see is the vast diversity of the different kinds of people, different things people are doing, because it's very different. You know, there's all these places where it's like the emphasis on this residential practice ritual all day. I saw that a lot. Other places are like, oh, we don't do much ritual. We're all into the secular mindfulness movement. Other places, there's a huge emphasis on climate change work, just as basic to what they're doing in their sangha. It's just quite various. So I would say it's hard to mark trends, but I'm interested in honoring, hearing, and making room for that whole chorus of voices to be seen. So in our diversity, something beautiful keeps moving forward. Yeah, Jason.
Ben, have you observed for yourself any sort of practice
after the events, it's back to you and your car, and any shifts goes in the between times.
So many. You know, personally for me, these things go from being like kind of hyper social to very alone. And so that's just a personal rhythm. But, you know, I get really inspired by different people. I don't necessarily think, oh, they did that and I have to do it. You know, like when I get these handcrafted gifts, I don't like doing handcrafts. So I'm just like, that's awesome. I want to talk about it so people for whom that is a gate of practice can see that it's elevated. So I'm not giving it the narrow view based on my preferences. So I think that's the thing that comes up a lot is when I see these different kinds of things people do and different ways they engage in liberative practice, I want to talk about that more to make more open Dharma gates. So that's what's coming up for me right now. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
You're talking about Sangha in a large way. I'm going to get a little personal. I just moved back to my family of origin Sangha a couple of months ago. And I knew pretty good, like, wow, isn't that cool? It's different. Oh, they do it this way. Oh, they do it this way. I am so not doing that in my family of origin. I'm moving back and I'm in Little Miss Superior mode of just like judgment. And I'm sitting with it and I'm learning and it's changing and getting better. But I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on practices for the immediacy of that.
So I just want to make it be clear. It just seems like you kind of got some values and changes in you, and then you're seeing people you're close to, they're not living that way, and you're judgmental about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I've never tried that. Definitely not. Yeah. It's real. Oh, man, I had all kinds of judgmental moments on this trip. Oh, I'm going that way. So, yeah, well, great thing to do. I mean, these are kind of basic instructions, but, you know, it's just a talk. You know, as I notice, like, I'm engaging in judgment, what's the root practice? To notice the body and let that open to noticing the emotion. So usually there's, like, it's afflictive. It's like, this is uncomfortable for me. And that always seems like not enough, and it's not the whole story. But just really developing that practice, you go, why are they doing that? It's like, all right, that's cool. How is this body right now? What is the feeling here? You start to, because this part is normally unconscious, so you begin to break the loop, that reactive loop, by seeing the process that creates it. And not by like getting a hammer to break it, but just the seeing. So Avalokiteshvara, we chanted her name over and over, Kanzeon, 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 to invoke the power of trust in just pulling our hands away and seeing what's here. It's hard to trust. So that's my first thought. Thank you. Okay, uno más, yes.
There is a large chunk of the population that would describe itself, I think, as spiritual but not religious. How do you see any of the centers that you visited as sort of effectively reaching?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm tempted to ask for a show of hands of people who are spiritual, not religious in this room, but I'm not going to do that. Oh, they're just going up. Yeah. It's just happening. And the amazing thing is there are people who are like, I'm spiritual, not religious. They're part of a Soto Zen Sangha, and they get up in the morning and chant sutras. People's understanding of their spirituality and their religious life is strange. Often they can't describe it at all. And oftentimes, I'm not trying to be offensive, it's not coherent. Mine probably isn't coherent. We don't quite know. So I would say it's probably very common that a lot of people are attracted to Buddhism that way. But I think probably your point is some people are like, I'm spiritual but not religious. I want to meditate and do Buddhism, but you guys are chanting and bowing all the time. I'm out of here. I was one of those people. And now I love Kool-Aid. anyway. that's anyway, you know, I found that those practices seem beneficial to me personally. But I think it's a good question to be addressing. And I do think in part probably the fact that many of the activity, about half of our activities here don't involve Soto Zen ritual, are a way to make an entrance point and a place of practice for people who may feel turned off by what looks like formal religious practice. So those are some ideas. Thank you. Jerry, by the way, was the attendant when I gave a talk at San Francisco Zen Center like 3 weeks ago. We're a team. It's a family. It's an international family. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. This has been really sweet to have this time with you. And I'm